Hi, everyone. Welcome to Partners for Progressive Israel's latest installment of Conversations with Israel and Palestine. I want to extend welcomes to everyone. We have people tuning in the U.S., Israel, Palestine, hopefully around, and other places in the world. Conversations with Israel and Palestine is a series of informational webinars that brings voices from Israel, Palestine, and elsewhere in the Middle East to an American and international audience. And the idea is to provide a link between progressives in the Middle East and those in the US and elsewhere. My name is Ron Skolnick. I organize these webinars for Partners for Progressive Israel. Before I hand it over to JJ Goldberg, our discussion moderator, just a few bits of housekeeping. First, I'll note that Partners for Progressive Israel is an American not-for-profit organization that's dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors, and that includes an end to Israel's occupation based on a two-state solution. Partners supports the idea of social justice, civil rights, and equality for all of Israel's inhabitants, and the organization cultivates Jewish-Arab partnerships and seeks to deepen Americans' understanding of Israel's and the region's complexities so they can better advocate for a progressive Israeli future. Partners is glad to be bringing you this webinar for free. But if you like program like this and I'd like to encourage more, please visit progressiveisrael.org, the organization's website, and make a contribution if you are able. I'll just also mention that Partners' next webinar is going to take place on Wednesday, February the 10th. Partners will be hosting Meretz Knesset member Tamar Zandberg and Ghaida Rinawi Zoabi, who are number two and number four, respectively, on the Meretz election list for the upcoming elections. And this webinar will be the kickoff event of the organization's new Women's Initiative. Okay, I've wrapped up the housekeeping. Let me now briefly introduce our panelists and moderator. Dr. Ehud Udi Eran is a senior lecturer of international relations at the University of Haifa in Israel, and he's an active board member at Mitvim, a leading Israeli think tank that deals with regional Israeli foreign policy. He is also a senior fellow at the Center for the Research of Intelligence Methodology. Currently, Dr. Eran is on sabbatical at Stanford University, and prior to his academic career, he held a number of positions in Israeli civil service, including as assistant to the Prime Minister's foreign policy advisor. Dr. Eran's co-panelist is Barbara Slavin. She is the director of the Future of Iran Initiative and a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. She's also a lecturer in international affairs at George Washington University, and a columnist for El Monitor, which is a website devoted to news both from and about the Middle East. She's the author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the US, and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. Last but not least, our moderator today is JJ Goldberg. He is an award-winning journalist and lecturer. He is the editor emeritus of the Jewish Daily Forward, where he is a former editor-in-chief. He's also served as bureau chief for the Jerusalem Report in the US and managing editor of the New York Jewish Week, and is the author of Jewish Power Inside the American Jewish Establishment. So with no further ado, I'll hand it over to JJ, and I'll see you at the other end to say goodbye.
Well, thank you, Ron, and look forward to seeing you later. Welcome everybody who's watching. I hope we can get into some of the live issues. We're talking about two countries in the Middle East that have been pretty much at odds with each other for quite some time. And since we're talking about two countries in the Middle East, I suppose we'll start where it all starts, which is Washington. The new Biden administration is apparently trying to move back toward the Iran nuclear deal, the joint JCPOA. Israel is very suspicious of that because Prime Minister Netanyahu was very much an opponent of the agreement between Western nations and Iran that was developed during the Obama administration. So now we're wondering what will happen if Biden moves back toward re-embracing the agreement, rejoining it, and how will Israel react? How will Iran react? So Barbara, let me start with you. Do you think Biden will re-enter? There's talk about him going in on condition that there's adjustments in the agreement. And the question, Iran has indicated that it won't accept any renegotiation. Where are we headed?
Well, I still think that the intention of the Biden administration is to rejoin the original Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, and then try to build on it, to extend in particular some of the conditions that had been set on the size and scope of Iran's nuclear program in return for other concessions that the United States would have to make. There's a rather short window for progress. Iran holds presidential elections in June, and the negotiators, the president, the administration that agreed to the JCPOA in 2015 won't be there anymore. After June, and it's entirely possible that the replacements will be much more difficult to deal with. So I think there's a sense of pressure. The Iranians also have been, over the last year, expanding their nuclear program, building up a stockpile of low enriched uranium of ever higher and higher concentrations. And they've set a sort of deadline of February the 21st to reduce their cooperation with international nuclear inspectors if there isn't progress on this issue. So I would expect that once Tony Blinken is confirmed as Secretary of State, which is probably gonna happen today, and the administration has a little longer to staff up, that we will see some sorts of contacts and some discussion of how both sides can return to compliance with the original deal. And then hopefully talks on other issues.
Udi, I'm wondering about a basic question of Israeli policy, which is that a lot of the progress in backing Iran away from nuclear weaponization began with Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech to the United Nations in 2012, where he held up that cartoon picture of a bomb and essentially said, Iran is such a negative player in the Middle East on the ground, disruption, terrorism. Imagine how bad it would be if it had a nuclear bomb. And so the nations of the world set about preventing it from getting a nuclear bomb anytime soon. And Israel now complains that it doesn't deal with Iran's bad behavior in the region, which sounds to me like a contradiction, but maybe I'm missing something.
I think historically the concern was that Iran will develop nuclear weapons, and this is a concern that goes back to the late 1990s. And more recent polling shows that many Israelis believe that Iran will have the bomb, it will actually use it. Of course, people who think about it strategically don't share this notion. And this, of course, plays into fears about the Holocaust and warning in advance. It's, of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu's one of his flag projects to warn from this in his self-image, I think, is a prophet that warns about fears. And however, in the last few years, we saw an Iran that's also much more active on Israel's borders. Its involvement in the Syrian civil war allowed it to deploy forces close to Israel's borders. And so I'm not sure it's a contradiction, but the set of concerns moved from these existential Holocaust-type apocalyptic scenarios to day-to-day realities of Iranian soldiers close to Israeli borders. So now we hear much more on the Israeli side, these almost tactical concerns about the friction close by, rather than this future nuclear mushroom.
Well, a few years back, I believe it was 2010, right after a year after Prime Minister Netanyahu entered his current round of tenures, that there were reports that he wanted the army to go on alert, on high readiness, in order to be prepared for an attack on Iran, and that the chief of the IDF, the chief of staff, and the head of the Mossad and the head of the Shin Bet Internal Security Agency all opposed him and managed to convince the security cabinet to drop it, to keep him away from that. And he replaced all three of them over the course of the next year. And in immediate train, the new head of the Mossad, who was supposed to be more compliant, told an annual gathering of Israeli ambassadors, this is 2011, I believe, that we should stop talking about Iran as an existential threat, because it's not. Israel's existence is not threatened. And then the following April or May of 2012, the new chief of staff, Benny Gantz, told Haaretz that Iran's leadership is rational, that they aren't going to do anything rash, and that they don't want a bomb in their pockets. They want to have readiness to achieve a bomb immediately as a threat without entering the pariah status. So the question is, right now, this is what I wanted to get at. There's a news report that just came out an hour ago, 2 hours ago, in Israel, in the Ynet website, that the IDF is asking for an extra 3 billion shekels, it's about $1 billion, immediately in order to prepare for its own attack on Iran and defense against the predictable ground response attacks from Hezbollah in Lebanon and from Hamas in the Gaza Strip. So has the IDF changed its attitude, its view? Has it increased its alarm about the Iranian threat?
I'll say one word about the very interesting background you presented. I think really historically, about a decade ago, there were sharp differences in the world view. Whereas Netanyahu looked at the threat in historical terms, you know, he looked towards Tehran and he may have seen Berlin, assuming he believes what he says. And the military and in general, the defense establishment took what we call in the social science jargon, a very realist approach, very material based. In other words, okay, they'll have the bombs and then what? There was even one more extreme statement by another general who was head of the R&D, General Yitzhak Ben Israel, he's now retired, that said, even in the extreme case that they use a bomb, we'll survive. It's the most extreme materialist response I saw to that. So on one level, we still have these two differences. Generals and security officials see the world in this very concrete material way, whereas the prime minister, son of a historian, takes a longer view, which of course serves him politically very well. The second layer, I think, is what you hinted is the personalities. These are hierarchical organizations and their leaders set the tone. Prime Minister Netanyahu is now in power for a long time, and the leadership of these institutions are in the balance, internal decision-making balance of power, the prime minister had grew stronger. The most evident is the head of the Mossad, Yossi Cohen, who almost hinted publicly that he's hoping to replace Netanyahu. He was very close with the Netanyahu circle when he was deputy head of the Mossad. So he's definitely not going to oppose Netanyahu the way some of his predecessors, especially Meir Dagan, did in the past. So that's the second layer. The third layer is what you mentioned just now about this requirements for a lot of budgets. Partly it's coincidence. We have this time exactly now, we have the INSS, that's Israel's leading think tank on security affairs, a conference, and the chief of staff was scheduled to talk there a long time ago. The IDF has its own motives to ask, as we discussed in our earlier talk, in our earlier discussion before this started. Some of it is budgetary. The current chief of staff came in with a plan to revitalize the IDF with very specific requirements for huge funding. Because of the corona, that was scrapped, and Iran offers an opportunity to rally this agenda. But there's also a strategic consideration here. We saw in 2010, 2012, that the IDF, according to some sources, got as much as $3 to $4 billion. It's not completely clear if it was genuinely preparing for an attack or creating international pressure to push the sides towards an agreement. There's a debate. So it could serve both purposes, higher level of preparedness, internal budgetary issues, but also a way to pressure whoever is going to negotiate to get to a deal that's closer to Israel's preferences.
Before we go on, I want to remind all of our viewers, if you have questions, type them in as we go along. We don't want to have you rush to type in and think of a question when we go to the question and answer period, which will be around 12 after 1, 10 after 1. So Barbara, the question about the dual intentions that Udi just raised in terms of the Israeli army, Iran has apparently stepped up its enrichment of uranium over the last year or two, They've gone from a commitment to a 3% enrichment, which is compatible with civilian use, to a 20% enrichment, which the agreement had barred them from doing. So they've essentially broken the agreement and stepped up to a move closer to a bomb readiness. The question is, are they, in Israel, this is being taken as an indication of how unreliable they are and how they don't keep their agreements. And elsewhere, especially in Europe, they're saying, no, this is the natural response to America's withdrawal from the agreement, that if you're going to drop out, then we will too. So the question is, can Iran be trusted to keep to its agreement, to go back to its full compliance, and maybe even get rid of the 20% material they've accumulated? Or is this a real indication of their unreliability?
Yeah. Well, I think the unreliability was on the U.S. side. Remember that Donald Trump pulled out unilaterally from the JCPOA in May of 2018 when Iran was in full compliance with it and had remained in full compliance for more than 2 years. So that is the original sin, as far as I'm concerned. Iranians didn't do anything for about a year. And then when it became clear that there was no prospect of negotiations with the Trump administration, and we remember Mike Pompeo and his maximum pressure campaign constantly increasing the sanctions on Iran, that's when they started to become more aggressive in the region, and also when they started to exceed the limits that were set in the JCPOA. They had a lot more 20% enriched uranium back in 2015, and they got rid of it in order to go into compliance. So this is fully reversible. Some of the steps they've taken, I mean, they've clearly accumulated some more expertise in terms of advanced centrifuges. You can't erase that knowledge. I mean, frankly, the whole argument about Iran and the bomb, I've been listening to this for almost 30 years now. And, you know, Bibi Netanyahu has been warning every other year, Iran will get the bomb next year. Iran will get the bomb next year. Iranians, they're good scientists. They're good physicists and engineers. If they want to make a bomb, they'll make a bomb. They know how. They've known how forever. It's a question of political will. It's a question of what do they think is in their strategic interests. And my sense has always been that they want the option of developing a bomb if they feel truly threatened existentially. But they understand that actually possessing bombs would put them in a worse situation, a weaker situation where they really would be threatened by Israel, which has nuclear weapons and many other advanced weapons that could attack Iran. So I'm fully confident that if a way can be found for the United States to return to compliance, that Iran will also go back into the deal. I think the bigger question for me is whether it's possible at all to build on this, whether it's possible to do anything about the regional tensions, which have been such a problem, which were not addressed by the JCPOA and which have gotten worse as a result of a number of things that really had nothing to do with the JCPOA, namely the US invasion of Iraq, which got rid of Saddam and opened Iraq to Iran. And of course, the Arab Spring, which destabilized Syria and opened Syria to Iran. These are other questions we can talk about. Iran's hostility toward Israel, Israel's hostility toward Iran takes two. But in terms of its nuclear obligations, I think that Iran will go back if the U.S. lifts sanctions.
It seems to me that Iran, the Arab Peace Initiative, which was adopted by the 22 members of the Arab League, the 22 Arab states, and then endorsed a year later by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which is 57 nations that are majority Islam, including the Arab countries. It adopted a plan in 2002, which Israel has never accepted, that offers Israel full recognition, normalization, and 22 embassies, or now 57 embassies, if it agrees to a Palestinian state more or less on the 67 border lines. The question is, Iran has voted for it consistently. It's been unanimous in the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. So that Iran is on record officially accepting the idea of an Israel next door to a Palestine, a Palestine next door rather than instead of Israel. Are we misreading the Iranian intentions when we say that Iran wants to eliminate and wipe Israel off the map?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of different attitudes, even within the Israeli, the Iranian government about Israel. There are some who really do want to see the end of Israel as Israel currently exists. But the standard line is that Iran will accept whatever the Palestinians will accept. Now, of course, the fly in that ointment is that some Iranians insist that the Palestinians, that there must be a referendum of all Palestinians all over the world, including the diaspora. Of course, if that were to happen, then you would have a radically different two-state solution. I think that the more troublesome aspect of the way this is all developed is that Iran has very strong relations with Hezbollah, which of course has fought a war with Israel. Iran has supported groups like Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which have had confrontations with Israel and have carried out terrorist acts. And so it's not so much a question of what Iran says, I think it's a question of what Iran does that has caused all of these problems. And frankly, these Abraham Accords, I think, open the possibility that more people in Iran will begin to see that their attitude toward Israel is really outdated and that it's absolutely silly from their point of view to be more Palestinian than the Arabs. Again, with smart diplomacy, we ought to be able to bring down the tensions instead of revving them up. But there are domestic politics in all of these places. Bibi Netanyahu has surfed on the Iranian wave for his entire career. And there are people in Iran who have also wrapped themselves in Holocaust denial and anti-Israel policies. So, you know, they feed off each other. And it's a terrible shame, frankly.
Now, Udi, over the last year, I guess, the Trump administration has succeeded in bonding Israel with formal relations with the Gulf states, with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, I think. And this is all attributed to the hostility and suspicion that the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia and its satellites, have toward Iran, that they're binding together and they're bringing their joint interests up above from underground. But it's also included Morocco and Sudan, who have no borders and no relationship with Iran. So it becomes a little unclear what will happen to the regional accords and to America's relationship in the Middle East if Biden actually moves back toward Iran and the nuclear agreement?
I think it's the approach of these Arab countries and the regional dynamics are affected not only by the Washington-Tehran axis, but the United States approach to the region as a whole. There is an impression in the region that goes back to the Obama days that the US is retreating from the area because of the decline of the significance of oil, because of the rise of China. And so some of these regional actors are looking around and seeing who can be our new allies. I don't think Israel can fill that place, but I think it's part of the drive. This is layered on top of historical relations that Israel had with these countries. Israel, clandestine Israeli-Moroccan relations go to the 1960s. And in the late 1990s, the two countries had diplomatic relations. And in the last 20 years, without diplomatic relations, tens of thousands of Israelis, including myself, had visited Morocco. In fact, Morocco now offers Israeli citizens the possibility to get Moroccan citizenship. So this is an upgrade of the same was happening with the Gulf for over two decades. There's a lot of business contacts. I know people who live in Israel and then on Monday they fly to the United Arab Emirates and do business there. So this is a two level game of strategic calculations that have to do in part with the US withdrawal from the region and not only the Iran issue and internal developments in the Arab world. I think an agreement in the short term will encourage these Arab countries to get even closer to Israel, at least those Arab countries that feel that Iran is a threat to them. But Israel, you should, as I'm sure you're aware, Israel saw itself for many years as apart from the Middle East. What we're seeing now, both eastwards towards the Gulf, but also westwards with the alliance with Greece and Cyprus, Israel is suddenly becoming a regional player. It really engages in the region after 100 years of Zionist dreams to do so. And it still remains to be seen how good we are going to be in this game. Being an alliance, playing in regional politics, that's a whole different game from simply using a hammer, which was a main tool of Israeli strategy for decades.
Well, once again, Barbara, if the Biden administration does re-enter the JCPOA, the joint agreement, the nuclear agreement, what will that do to America's relations with its main allies in the Middle East, with Saudi Arabia, with Morocco, with the Gulf states, with the UAE? Will there be a freezing of America's relations with its traditional allies, or will they get over it?
I think there are going to be some more strains, but you know, Iran is not the only issue. Saudi Arabia has made itself very unpopular in Washington because of a number of actions, including the war in Yemen, which has turned out terribly for Mohammed bin Salman. And of course, the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the US-based dissident journalist in Turkey. The unnecessary rift with Qatar, the shakedown in the Ritz of Saudi business people, the kidnapping of the Lebanese prime minister. I mean, there's, you know, the fact that there are still women in prison in Saudi Arabia for advocating the right to drive, which women have now been granted by the king and Mohammed bin Salman, his son. So we have a lot of problems with Saudi Arabia, and this will, I assume, add some new strains. The Saudis have to deal with lower oil prices, with a lot of economic problems, the need to somehow attract investment to a country like that, which has no transparency and no rule of law. You know, good luck with that. So I don't know to what extent the Iran issue will then become a new irritant. The United Arab Emirates has mixed views. I mean, Abu Dhabi hates Iran, but Dubai does business with Iran. And there are a lot of Iranian expatriates in the United Arab Emirates. It's not really an issue, as Udi pointed out, for Morocco or for Sudan. So we will see. I mean, all of these relations will have to go through a kind of review process now that the Biden administration is in, and it will not be carte blanche the way it was under Trump. But the U.S. will continue to consult with these countries. Of course, I think there's already been a conversation between Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, and the Israeli National Security Advisor. Nobody will be kept in the dark about what the U.S. intends to do. And the Biden people have been very clear, both in the campaign after the election and in confirmation hearings, what their views are on a number of issues.
Udi, I interviewed Uzi Arad a few years ago, former longtime foreign policy advisor to Netanyahu, who broke with him right around the time that all of those other security officials broke away over Iran. He said that a unilateral Israeli attack on Iran would completely backfire, that it would allow Iran to go to the world and say, look, we were attacked by the only nuclear power in the region, so now we're entitled to have a nuclear weapon, and hardly anybody would stand in its way. Further, that when Israel bombed the Iraqi nuclear reactor back in 1981, it was supposed to be a great victory against proliferation in the Arab states. It turned out 10 years later, when senior George Bush invaded Iraq, that they had taken their nuclear program and taken it underground. And so when the American troops took over Iraq, Iraq backed away from the nuclear program, and that for when George Bush Jr. invaded, there turned out to be no Iraqi program. The argument is that when you attack and bomb a nation in order to try and stop its nuclear weapons, you need to have inspectors on the ground to make sure that they aren't spreading it around the country. An Israeli attack would not allow or lead to inspectors. Certainly they won't allow Israeli inspectors, and the rest of the world will back away. So that the only people who could attack Iran and make it stick would be the Americans with Europe allied. So it's sort of a conundrum, I think. Is there an Israeli plan that involves follow-up?
Yeah, you raise a good question. Of course, we don't exactly know what are the operational considerations, but there is an internal debate in the defense establishment between people who take Uzi's perspective, which is somewhat affected by his very acrimonious relationship now with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and others that say it's worth, although we think it will may roll back the plan, the program in a while, as you say, it'll actually speed it up on a longer term. But there are people who think it will take it back in a few years, and even just showing the determination by itself is worth doing. Here again, you have to look at Israeli strategic culture, which for many years relied in its own self-image on a self-help, not waiting for some international coalitions. And the two examples of the 1981 attack in Iraq and the 2007 attack on the Syrian nuclear power plant are considered in Israel a success. Although we know from more detailed research, at least regarding Iraq, that perhaps the opposite had happened. So the strategic culture is, if the great powers will not solve our problem, we will have to self-help. Israel was not very good in other cases like Lebanon 1982 or in a specific follow-up that include this nuanced, complex diplomatic structures that you offered. Until now, the defense establishment was closer to the position you presented. There are too many risks. It's not only the lack of follow-up, but also just the image of, you know, potentially 10 Israeli pilots in Iranian presented on Israeli television. Israel went bananas when one soldier was kidnapped into Gaza, you know, which is a few kilometers from Israeli border. So imagine what would happen in a potential attack when there's much more POWs. So there is an internal debate. It's over exactly these issues. I'm not sure we are very good at planning beyond what happens beyond the attack. What we do know, the lessons from Iraq and Syria, there's a lot of unknowns. Huge risks were taken by Israeli governments in 81 and 2007. And in the Israeli self-image, they paid off.
Now, you mentioned the Israel's relations with the European powers, the great powers, I think you called them. And I guess that includes China and Russia, which were brought into the, I mean, they became active participants under Obama's leadership, I think. The question is, especially among Iran, Netanyahu's base, his political base, there is a feeling that Europe is not pro-Israel. It's not Israel's friend. Europe believes that it is. A lot of Israelis believe that it's the old Europe that persecuted Jews. What should we be looking at in terms of Europe's attitude toward Israel?
In the Iranian context?
Yes.
Well, the Iranians, the Europeans always took a different approach from the United States. Going back again to the 1990s, they highlighted this idea of a constructive dialogue between the European Union and Iran. In other words, we should communicate with Iran, but share our concerns. I think in Israel, it was perceived as a naive approach. Seen from Jerusalem, Iran did not live up to its commitment to the NPT, and the Europeans in their general naivete went along with the Iranian narrative. My own opinion is that one of the achievements of the Obama administration was the ability to bring all these players on board, including the Europeans. But when we look at Europe now, it's a bit like what I said earlier about Obama. You have to look at it in the broader context of what is now the EU in general. It's a much weaker institution. You know, the UK had left. Israel has now some very strong allies among Eastern European countries and the East Mediterranean countries. And so we don't have a unified EU position, again, at least as it was seen from Israel, as we had before. Having said that, Israel does need some channel to communicate with Hezbollah or with Iran, and this was Germany, a trusted ally of Israel in Europe. So although we have this public a concern in Israel about Europe, it's now weakened because of the weakening position of the Europeans and because historically Germany actually played quite an important role, I think, in this quiet dialogue that Israel was holding with Hezbollah over very tactical issues, but nevertheless an important channel.
It's when I was a kid growing up in the 60s, I wanted to get a harmonica to go with my guitar, and the only good harmonicas were made in Germany, and my parents wouldn't let me buy one because they were German. And now Germany is Israel's main ally in Europe. It's I guess that also points to the possibility of changes on the ground and in relationships. Barbara, there is talk of the Biden administration having to navigate carefully between its relations with Europe, which it wants to improve, and its relations with Israel, which it wants to maintain. The European thing is primarily a foreign policy consideration in terms of strategy and America's place in the world. There are those who say that its Israeli conundrum has more to do with American domestic politics. Do you sense any thinking in the Biden administration about those two as conflicting impulses, conflicting interests?
An interesting question. I must admit, I haven't really thought about it very much. I think the Europeans are just so happy that Joe Biden was elected and that he is going to consult with them. He's not going to tell them what to do. He's not going to have temper tantrums. He's going to go to all the summits. And I'm looking forward, and you know, we're the Atlantic Council, so obviously we believe in strong transatlantic relations, but I'm looking forward to the Europeans playing a helpful role on Iran. After all, they all have embassies there, and they're all still part of the Iran nuclear deal, and helping us find our way back into that agreement and hopefully build on it. So, you know, there are differences over Israel. I know, you know, we'll see how Bibi decides to play this, how confrontational he's going to be. Fortunately, annexation, I think, is off the table now for a while, and we have the United Arab Emirates to thank for that. But there's certainly the settlement movement is increasing. Palestinians are still being treated terribly. So there are potential points of friction. I don't think the Palestinian issue is going to be a priority for a while, though, primarily because of the weakness of the Palestinians themselves and the fact that they have leadership issues that they have to work out probably. There'll be a Palestinian mission of some sort in Washington again. The U.S. will be consulting with them. They won't be blacklisted like they were under Trump.
Let me move to some audience questions. They're coming in pretty rapidly at this point. We have one here from Ralph Seliger, a friend of mine. Is there any evidence that Iran has kept some facilities and nuclear development hidden from the international inspectors, as some critics of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, have alleged? Who wants to take that?
I think one thing we've learned is that if Iran tries to hide anything, Israel finds it. So I'm actually pretty confident that we know everything about their program. I mean, do they have a few centrifuges in a basement somewhere? Yeah, probably. But if there were anything major, I mean, Their program has been penetrated by Israeli intelligence pretty thoroughly. Look how Israel assassinated their chief nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh back in August. Even though Iran doesn't have an active weapons program as far as we know, and this guy was associated with work that was active two decades ago, Israel found him and had him killed. So I don't think the Iranians would get away with anything. Meanwhile, the International Atomic Energy Agency routinely inspects all 17 declared facilities. They have cameras that monitor 24/7. So as long as the inspectors are there, I'm reasonably confident. My worry is that if we don't get back into the JCPOA pretty quickly, this is going to escalate. Iran's going to reduce cooperation with the IAEA. And then we'll be in the situation like we were with Iraq after Saddam kicked out inspectors, I think in 98, where we won't know exactly what's going on and everybody will assume the worst. So I hope we can avoid that.
Udi, let me throw this one to you. There's a question from Mark Fishman, I believe it is, or Fickman. If the US wants to rejoin the JCPOA, how will the other parties, particularly China and Russia, respond? Will they seek a quid pro quo? And let me add to that two aspects. One is, if in deference to Israel or on its own, the Biden administration tries to force Iran to renegotiate, will the Chinese and the Russians balk and pull out or hit back? And the other question is the long-term strain in Israel between its relations with China and its relations with Washington, where Washington has pressured Israel to downgrade its relations with China, and Israel has basically ignored that at some cost.
Maybe I'll start with the third point, and I think it does relate to the two first ones in the sense that Chinese and Russian positions about Iran will no doubtedly be affected by the broader agenda. Although the incoming administration has a lot of Obama people, I think they are coming and they had joined the Washington consensus that China is a competitor, but a rival. And so this will be one of the items between the American Chinese and American Russian agendas, which both are intuitively, you know, look with some strains, the Navalny arrest on the Russian front, and so on. As I said earlier, one of the achievements of the Obama administration was the ability to bring these other two players on board. They are both very important. China is a huge buyer of Iranian oil. Russia had provided originally a lot of the nuclear know-how to the Iranians. And so we'll have to see how these broader relationships develop. As for the point between the US and China, the US had been putting pressure on Israel going back from the late 1990s to roll back some aspects of the relationship. Israel in general did oblige. After two traumatic events in 2000, 2005 of arms supplies, Israel halted all arms supplies to China under American pressure. And more recently, there's more targeted American pressure on curtailing Chinese investments in Israel. Secretary Pompeo came to Israel the eve of a tender for some water desalination project, which a Chinese company was about to buy. And literally 2 days later, the Chinese lost the bid. So at the end of the day, Israel will try to balance, and to Prime Minister Netanyahu's benefit, we should say, he balanced it quite well, I think. Ability to maintain economic relationship with China and close strategic alliance with Israel. But it's at the moment of decision, the US, Israel will choose as it had done before, I think, the alliance with the United States. The security establishment that's very dominant is very close to the US. So you see an internal discussion between a very powerful security establishment in some sectors of the economic players who do want Chinese involvement. But ultimately, I think it's also, I mean, you are the editor of The Forward, you know it. Israel is also very attuned to what's happening with Jews abroad. Half of the Jewish people live in the United States. So no matter what happens, the US will always be a priority for Israeli decision makers.
I'm gonna throw this one to both of you. One of the questioners asks whether Qatar could prove to be a bridge between Israel and Iran. Qatar has a relationship with Iran. Obviously, that's one of the reasons that it's kind of boycotted and pariah to the other Gulf states. And at the same time, it has been Israel's channel to Hamas in many cases. And I would add, Qatar chairs the Arab Peace Initiative Implementation Committee. It was Qatar that led the move to soften the Arab Peace Initiative and let Israel keep some of the territory by swapping. So is there any basis for hoping that Qatar can upgrade its relationship in the region with its fellow Arab and Gulf states and also become some sort of a bridge between Israel and Iran? Barbara, why don't you answer first and then Udi?
Yeah, I suppose it could pass messages, but I mean, Oman has traditionally been the message passer between the United States and Iran. And of course, also Bibi Netanyahu visited Oman. There are plenty of mediators. I mean, let's be honest, there've been track two dialogues between former Israeli and former Iranian officials. I've been in the room when some of these people have met. So I think that you can do it directly through these formers. You can do it through Europe, through many, many possible means if there is a desire to do that. And Germany also was mentioned as a good intermediary. I don't know, Udi, if you have any other thoughts about who could pass messages.
Yeah, I think you pointed pretty much to the main channels, and it is interesting to see how as this rivalry evolves and now is almost a direct military confrontation with Israeli attacks and Iranian attacks in Syrian territory, who will do the coordination historically, right. You know, so there are multiple channels. I will add one more thing, which is not exactly Qatar, but the more Israel gets engaged with Gulf countries, the more Israelis go to the Gulf, the more Gulf investments we have in Israel. I think part of the imagination of Israeli strategic thinker widens. You know, Israel supposedly is very strong in the region, but it's the formative experience of Israeli strategic leaders do not include understanding the Gulf. For example, understanding the role of Asia in Gulf thinking, even the physical proximity, the Indian food, the broader set of considerations that are seen from the Gulf. And so this opening that we saw with the Abraham Accords and the fact that there's going to be more open academic exchanges, elite exchanges, I think will create in a broader sense an easier ability to communicate through these various channels that Barbara had pointed to.
Yeah, I'd forgotten to mention the Russians. Obviously, the Russians in Syria have been very, very influential and have kind of played both sides off against each other, I would say. Certainly Israel has had free rein in Syria. Russians haven't done anything about it. And the Iranians are very angry at the Russians about that, but they don't really have any recourse since they needed the Russians' air power to keep Assad in place. So there are a lot of potential channels, depending on the topic.
There is a question here from Jeremy Roth Kushel. What are the consequences? What consequences for Israel's approach to Iran will there be in terms of American political relations with Russia, the Russian-Israeli-UAE-Saudi hybrid, and the Russian entry into the region over the last 5 years, really, as the main hegemon with the withdrawal of the United States. Israel has a whole new relationship with Russia, I believe. And will this change with the Biden administration? Will there be more of a leveling off? Or do you want to try that?
Well, the Russian issue is that after 20 years of Israeli military dominance in the space, in the immediate space to Israel, suddenly there's a great power on our borders, Russian forces deployed in Syria that constrain or has the potential to constrain Israeli activities. This led to a tactical mechanism of coordination because, as Barbara mentioned, there is a military activity of both Israel and Russia in the same space. So this is a concrete problem for military planners that will have to be dealt with regardless of the, you know, whatever the Biden administration does. It is true that Israel had the free rein, but it entailed a lot of effort on the part of Prime Minister Netanyahu, including publicly semi-humiliating himself. I think in 1 year, he met 5 times President Putin. In one event, Putin kept in waiting for 2 hours to make a point, who is the great power and who is the regional power. And so, again, it will remain to be seen what will be the American-Russian developments. But regardless of what happens on that realm, the military presence in Syria is something that will force Israel to continue and engaging with the Russians. And that's even separate from the fact that, 15 or 20% of the Israeli population had emigrated from the former Soviet Union. And some of our leaders, such as former Minister of Defense Lieberman, you know, continuously visit the former Soviet Union. And their worldview does leave a place for Russia, simply even because the way they grew up.
Now, the other question that comes to mind in that context is Iran's presence on the ground in Syria. Iran has a fairly serious presence, I believe. It's been downgraded somewhat. I think it was a Russian general visited Israel a few years ago and committed to keeping Iran a certain number of kilometers away from Israel's Golan border. Can Russia be relied on to play that role? Can America step in? Is there any hope of Israel achieving what it wants, which is the removal of Iran's troops from Syrian soil altogether? Barbara?
Maybe I'll start, you follow up. Iran doesn't have a large presence of its own now. What it does have are militias, Shia militias that it has groomed with you know, people coming from as far as Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and then the Shia militias in Syria, Syrian militias as well. And then it has members of its Quds force, its external intelligence and military arm that has organized them. Hezbollah has provided training for a lot of these people. There aren't that many Iranians per se, I think, in the country. And Udi can correct me if I'm wrong. I think the main concern now is not so much the numbers of personnel, but the fact that the Iranians are able to move rockets through Iraq into Syria and into Lebanon to support Hezbollah. And also that the Iranians have tried to construct factories for precision missiles in Syria and in Lebanon. And these have been targets for Israel. But the personnel themselves, I mean, there have been cases obviously when Iranian generals and others have been killed in Syria and the Russians, I guess, turned a blind eye. But it's more the logistics trail that is of concern. And I, you know, I don't know how you deal with that. The US is not gonna go in and police the place. So it's Israel, you know, with this war between the wars, I guess, with Russian acquiescence.
When Joe Biden became vice president, which is what, 12 years ago, 11 years ago, he first visited Israel, and Netanyahu responded with an accelerated, a sudden announcement of new settlement building over the Green Line. I think it was in Jerusalem, which caused a lot of tension. It sort of humiliated Biden and the Obama administration in general, and was one of the big steps early on in souring relations, I believe. So now, as shortly before the inauguration of Biden as president, Israel announced a sudden acceleration of building in the West Bank, permitted a whole new round of construction in the settlements. Is that a signal of Israel's intent to have rotten relations? Udi?
Look, the U.S. is Israel's closest ally, and alongside this declaration about the settlements, Tzachi Hanegbi was a minister very close to Netanyahu, started saying, you know, the prime minister and Biden and President Biden know each other for 30 years. Biden is a friend of Israel. So this is, although clearly Prime Minister Netanyahu preferred President Trump, there's already effort to signal that relationship will continue. It's been a cornerstone of Israeli foreign policy, no matter who is there, not to be confrontational. Of course, Netanyahu did break with it in speaking to Congress about Iran on things he thought were existential. Settlement question is partly vis-a-vis the US, but partly is internal. We are seeing a growing process in the last few years of essentially integrating the West Bank into Israel. Israel may have given up on the formal annexation, but the size of settlers, the nation state law, a lot of practical things on the ground do indicate integration. The question is how much the Biden administration will take this thing seriously. It was a big thing, of course, with President Obama, but with the decline of the issue, not only among weakness of the Palestinians, as Barbara pointed out earlier, but also the fact the Arab world is less interested in that, I think will decrease the motivation of a U.S. administration to confront Israel on that issue.
Barbara, I'm going to ask you one more question that's been asked by a number of listeners, especially Lynn Siegel. What extent America seems to be ignoring the role that it played in the 1950s in deposing an Iranian prime minister, Mossadegh, was it? And reinstalling the Shah, who had a very unpopular reign from the early 50s until 1977 when he was overthrown. The tension and hostility from Iran toward the United States. Does anybody in Washington remember and understand the role that Washington played in souring the relations and creating the current impasse?
It was 1979 when the Shah was overthrown. No, we only remember our own grievances. We never remember others. I mean, frankly, you know, 1953 is a long time ago, but Iranians really remember that the U.S. supported Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War and that the U.S. shot down a civilian Iranian airliner in 1988 at the end of the Iran-Iraq War, killing all 290 people, I think, on board, something for which the U.S. Has never really apologized properly. Madeleine Albright made a few efforts. Iranians also know that they were of assistance to the U.S. after 9/11 and getting rid of the Taliban. For that, they got put on the axis of evil. They offered a grand bargain in 2003, and George W. Bush didn't even respond to the offer. You know, they have a lot of grievances on their side. Of course, we only think about the hostages that they took American diplomats hostage in 1979 and held them for 444 days, and that the Quds Force gave IEDs to Iraqi militias who killed Americans after the U.S. invaded Iraq. You know, my view is that there are just so many grievances on both sides. We're like a married couple who's gone through a very, very bitter divorce. And the best we can hope for is to try to tone it down for the sake of the children, namely Iranians and all the people who live in the Middle East who are caught in between these two opposing powers. Once we start, you know, it's like old women comparing their surgical scars. I mean, if we just keep going down that road of yes, we did this, no, you did that, we're not going to get anywhere. So, you know, I hope Biden will have a new approach. I hope he'll be very pragmatic and see what we can accomplish. It may not be much, but it's going to be, I think, at least refreshing to see the attempt after 4 years of Donald Trump.
Well, thank you. I think that's all we've got time for now. I'm going to throw this back now to Ron Skolnick from the Partners for Progressive Israel to walk us out. Hey, Ron, it's all yours.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thanks, J.J. Goldberg, Barbara Slavin, Udia Ron. For a really fascinating and in-depth conversation. Also, thanks to my colleagues at Partners for Progressive Israel for all the work in getting this to happen, what goes on behind the scenes. I'll just mention before closing, for those who joined a little bit late, Wednesday, February 10 is Partners' next webinar. It's gonna be part of the organization's new women's initiative. And Partners is going to host Tamar Zandberg, Meretz MK, and Raida Ranawi Zoabi, who is number four on the merits list. They're going to be talking about the upcoming elections, of course, and I'm sure a lot about increased efforts within the merits party to forge greater Jewish-Arab political partnership. Last but not least, Partners is delighted to bring the programming to you for free. But of course, that depends on that ability depends on donor support. So if you're able to, of course, progressiveisrael.org, take a look at and watch out for future programming and make a contribution when you're able. Thanks so much and hope to see you again next time.
I just want to add regarding the February 10th program, anytime you have an opportunity to listen to Tamar Zandberg, grab it. She's a personality who's really going to leave an impact.
Indeed.